Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Tooman, Professor of Political and Legal Communications, yakety yakety, at San Francisco State. It's my pleasure tonight, by the way, to introduce Jeffrey Nunberg, Professor in the School of Information at UC Berkeley, and also a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at that other school that's not as good at Berkeley, Stanford University. I'm an old blue, sorry. It's a fine university. Also, by the way, the distinguished author of The Years of Talking Dangerously, which we'll be talking about tonight, among many other books. I'd like to add in talking about this that our presentation tonight, we will be talking about, again, the importance of language and words in the ways that we discuss and develop and evolve culture. And particularly with respect to culture, how we talk about the politics of our culture. Many of these terms in our language in the past many years, including expressions like culture wars, even the old standbys right and left wing, liberal, progressive, when liberal became a bad word, or as confused as people are today about the word conservative, and what does that mean? Democrat, Republican, what do these expressions mean? Militaristic terms like Islamofascism, or words like torture, for example, war on terror, are all examples of language that have been used really just in the past couple of years, past many years, really, last two presidential terms, certainly, to if not guide, then in many ways almost dictate the nature of political discourse in this country. And it does seem that as we approach this discussion tonight, that the times are changing a little bit. So please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Nunberg, who will be addressing many of these subjects tonight in our talk with his book, The Years of Talking Dangerously.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for coming. This book, I'll hold it up, is kind of a snapshot of the language over the last part of the Bush era. Now, to talk about an era is always a little bit misleading, of course, particularly with regard to something as vast as the language. You think of one of those ads you see on television for the hits of the 70s compilations where you get all these images jumbled together, the Streakers and Kent State and Saturday Night Fever and Gasoline Lines and the music playing is Gloria Gaynor and the Clash together. There's something of that effect when you look at what's happened over the language. There's so many things going on that have their effects on the language that it's hard to pull them together in a coherent way. The language reflects, for example, all of the changes in technology that we've been experiencing. In fact, there's been a change not just in the sense that technology always throws off new words, but that the tenor of the language has changed. We used to have all these sort of wonky tech terms 10 or 15 years ago. People were talking about universal resource locators and DNS servers and so on. And now all of a sudden it's about blogs and tweets. Right, and not to mention friending is the friendly word in itself. There are these other shifts that reflect these very subtle changes in the culture that might be hard to put your finger on if they didn't make themselves known in the language. All of a sudden, after hundreds of years of being nasty to one another, we needed a new word, snarky, to describe a new form of nastiness. Or one that I have a piece in the book about and that I think is particularly interesting is the new uses to which we put the word I mean, is this word that goes back to Chaucer's time, a very useful way of announcing that you need some time to gather your thoughts. And it was living this happy life in the fringes of the English vocabulary for 800-900 years, and then somebody got the idea, you know, we could use that word as a kind of a playful way of correcting somebody else's errors or making fun of somebody else's errors, as in, Ringo was the band's drummer. Right. What's amazing is that it took 900 years for somebody to come up with that, but we did. And then there are these odd terms that seem to come out of nowhere to spend 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 weeks in the news and then disappear. Persistent vegetative state, for example. That lasted about a month, if you remember it. Macaca, fascinating word. This word appeared exactly once in the history of American public discourse. Just one time was it used. And it was sufficient not only to turn a Senate race, but actually to throw, as it happened, to throw control of the Senate from the Republicans to the Democrats. Now, not many words can make that claim. Dwarf planet, another word that dates itself from a very particular moment. And an interesting word, I think, because it shows how these debates about semantics can infest even the reaches of the hard sciences, where you'd think people wouldn't really care about semantics. After all, this thing, whatever you call it, this little chunk of ice is revolving around the sun a billion miles away or whatever it is, and it is what it is, whatever you call it. It could care less whether we call it a dwarf planet or a trans-Neptunian object or a planet or whatever. But nonetheless, everybody got worked up about it, not just the public, which had grown up thinking of Pluto as a planet, but the scientists themselves, the astronomers themselves. And finally, they came up with this definition of a planet that they announced would fit only the solar system. This definition was good only for the solar system, which is sort of like the decision that the Supreme Court came up with in Bush v. Gore, what they call results-oriented jurisprudence. It's sort of like coming up with a definition of mammal that only holds for North America, right? But it's an indication of how pervasive these debates about language can be. We tend to think of ourselves, or Americans tend to think of themselves, as people uninterested in language. People rarely mention the word semantics without prefacing it with mere semantics, like mere rhetoric and mere labels, as if we're a business-like, practical people. We don't have time to bandy words. This is just a matter of semantics. In fact, if you look at how pervasive these debates over language are at every stage of American public life, you realize that we're a people deeply involved in semantics. And in fact, you could write the history, the political and social history of the last 10 years or maybe the last century just by looking at the debates over meaning and semantics that people were engaged in. Just think back over recent years. Marriage, for example, the traditional meaning of marriage, people say, as if they were defending not an institution. But I really don't care about gay marriage. It's just that I'm interested in defending the English language. And you people say that. Looting. After Katrina, there was this debate about looting. Is it looting if you take bread and water out of a convenience store to feed your family? How about if you take battery-powered power tools out of a hardware store? Well, maybe if you're trying to sell them, but not if you're trying to get granny out of the attic. And people all of a sudden had to deal with the subtleties, ethical and semantical, of a concept that they had just taken for granted before. And I think what this all shows is how important this is, how you really don't know how to feel about something, how to judge something, until you know what to call it. And, of course, over the last few years, repeatedly and now again in the news, in fact, in today's paper, as Obama announces that he won't be releasing the photos, the new photos of from Guantanamo and so on, this word torture, which has been central to the political and public debates over the last 5 years, it first came up in just about almost exactly 5 years ago, a little more than 5 years ago, when the Abu Ghraib photographs came out. And what was very interesting is if you looked at the press then, the European press, German, French, Italian, English, were all using the word torture, whatever their politics. Even Rupert Murdoch's Times was calling it torture in the UK, not Rupert Murdoch's Fox Network here, but Rupert Murdoch's Times in the UK. In the US, almost nobody used what Rumsfeld called the torture word throughout that period, maybe because they were reluctant to engage what they felt would be a barrage of right-wing criticism if they went there, maybe because they found it difficult to accept that Americans could do these things. There were a lot of people who aggressively and belligerently poo-pooed the idea that this was torture. Rush Limbaugh said, well, it's no different than what happens at the Skull and Bones initiation. I'm talking about people having a good time. You ever hear of emotional release? You ever hear of some need to blow some steam off and so forth? That was one attitude that that people took. Other people would make light of it. There was a kind of swagger with which people addressed this, both right after Abu Ghraib and in the light of subsequent revelations about Guantanamo. Loud music, well, if that's torture, then every teenager tortures his parents. Sleepless is why there's no mother in America who gets eight hours worth of sleep. And this general sense that you could dismiss this, that Americans in any event didn't and couldn't do this stuff. And I think that idea, whether you were defending it belligerently or whether people were made very uncomfortable by what was being revealed, is one that's wrapped into the meaning of the word itself. Maybe not the literal meaning, the dictionary meaning, but words have not only literal dictionary meanings, but they conjure up certain stereotypes. You know, bachelor, if you look in the dictionary, it says an unmarried man. But there's a stereotype of Steve Martin or George Hamilton IV or Hugh Hefner. You know, if I say Pope Benedict's a bachelor, you step, although he's not married, as far as we know. And the same is true with torture. When you think of torture, you think in particular, depending on your generation, of images from the movies above all else. You think of Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man. You think of Gert Frobe in Goldfinger. No, Mr. Bond, I want you to die. You think of Lives of a Bengal Lancer, a pretty much forgotten Gary Cooper film, except that it left us with this famous line that survived the movie, we have ways of making men talk. The character of Muhammad Khan is the name of the character, by the way. So when we think of torture, stereotypically, we think of something foreign and alien. In fact, even when you're a kid and there are these torture games that kids play, that kind of play torture, we always give them the names of, we always give them foreign names. There's the Indian or the Chinese rope burn, the Dutch rub, the Russian haircut. I don't know how many of those names. There's some smiles here, so some people remember that. But even when you're 8 years old, you know, Americans don't do this stuff. This is something the Russians and the Chinese do and so on. So there was a lot of discomfort at the idea that Americans might, in fact, do this stuff, that this was something you would see not just from Anthony Hopkins or Laurence Olivier, but from those pudding-faced kids in Abu Ghraib. And, in fact, one reaction on the part of the administration, rather than poo-pooing it, was to bureaucratize it, to use these euphemisms of an extraordinary sort, alternative sets of procedures, or this remarkable phrase, enhanced interrogation techniques, which is back with us now. It's interesting because this administration was usually very deft with language, and there's a clunky wooden sound to it, almost as if it were meant to be provocative. There was also, along with that, this sense that this was all just a matter of procedure, routine procedure. Bush talked about it in one speech and used the word professionals 26 times in this one speech. What I'm proposing is that there be clarity in the law so that our professionals will have no doubt that that which they are doing is legal. So the piece of legislation I sent up there provides our professionals with that which is needed to go forward and so on and so forth. The professionals suggesting not only that these people knew what they were doing, but that they weren't taking any pleasure in it. This debate continues, and what's interesting about it is even though we know increasingly more about exactly what happened, people, their decision as to what to make of it depends on what they're going to call it, whether they use what Rumsfeld called the torture word or not. And semantic debates like this really occur in every period, back to the beginning of the country. But I think they've played a particular role over the last 10 years, and in particular over the years of the Bush administration and more recently. Now, every age, when you think back on the language of any age, you think of one characteristic kind of language that defines the age. So you think back on the 60s, sex, drugs, revolution, disaffection, that's the language we remember now. You think of the 70s, it's the language of several, the language of new age language. I'm in a good space. When was the last time you heard that? But that's the language we think of in terms of the 70s. The 80s, management jargon, and valley girl slang, as if, not even, And in the 90s, it was more management speak. It was tech talk. It was fit speak or fit talk. Boy, is he cut that way of talking. But in the opening years of this century, it has been, I think, more than anything else, the language of politics that occupies our attention. Now, there are several reasons for that. I mean, partly the stakes rose considerably after 9/11, and politics and policy became much more central concerns for Americans than they had been in the previous few decades. There was the increased polarization of American political life, at least at the level at which it's articulated by the pundits and the columnists and the radio hosts and politicians and the papers themselves, whether or not ordinary people are actually that polarized about it. And there was the sense, increasingly, that language, as much as anything else, was responsible for the way things were in America, particularly on the left and particularly among Democrats. After the 2004 election, there was an extraordinary amount of self-examination on the part of the Democrats. How is it that these people keep voting for these Republicans when it's against their own interest to do so and so forth? What could it be other than that the Republicans are selling them a snappy line of patter? And so you got all this talk about framing and messaging and rebranding and so forth, and there was this all these efforts to come up with new language because we need new language, and that's how the rights that's how the left is going to overcome these political deficiencies. Joe Klein said the problem with the Democrats is they have bad bumper stickers. That was the charge. Now, it certainly seemed at that time as if the Bush administration in general, in particular, and the right and conservatives in general, had established an extraordinary hegemony, an extraordinary predominance in American political language. They had succeeded in moving the center of gravity of the American language to the right. And if you looked, even the place to look for this really wasn't so much in the right-wing media, Fox News or the Washington Times or National Review, but in the New York Times or the Washington Post, the so-called liberal media, as Eric Alterman calls them, where you would see, for instance, that a word like values was three or four times as likely to occur in the neighborhood of conservative and Republican as in the neighborhood of Democratic and liberal. So even in those media, there was a sense in which the language of the right was dominant. And Bush was extraordinarily successful in putting his language over with the media. Death tax, for example, was a phrase, a Republican invention. And by the middle of the Bush administration, about a third of the newspapers in this country had just abandoned calling it the estate tax and were calling it the death tax. Ownership society, the substitution of personal accounts for private accounts in connection with Social Security, all of these phrases were established in the press because of the influence of the Bush administration, its allies in the right-wing media, the think tanks, politicians, and so forth. So it really seemed, you can understand from the standpoint of 2004, why that the regime that had been established was a linguistic one as much as a political one. Within 4 years, that's fallen apart. It's unraveled. The language both of the Republican administrations and of the culture war language of the right is in tatters now, is in shambles. And I think that not only people on the left and Democrats, but Republicans to varying degrees appreciate that their problems are not just problems of policy, but linguistic problems. You could think of it as beginning in 2006 when the administration started to issue what I think of as slogan recalls. In the fall of 2006, Bush famously said to George Stephanopoulos, "Well, George, we've never been stay the course," which occasioned for most of us to react, "Hello, excuse me?" Even Fox News couldn't resist showing footage of Bush saying, "We're stay the course, stay the course, stay the course." Shortly after that, the administration floated Islamofascism as a phrase. It went nowhere. Within a couple of months, the administration had dropped it, though the right-wing media continue to use it. And all of the other phrases that were associated with the administration were one after another abandoned or altered or recalled. wanted dead or alive, morphed into Bush's, I don't know where he is, and I'm truly not concerned about him. Freedom is untidy, bring him on. The more memorable and pithy the slogan was, the more it came back to haunt the administration, the more the administration tried to distance themselves from it. And, of course, the classic instance is mission accomplished aboard the USS Lincoln in 2003. Just before the 2008 election, Bush was asked if he had any regrets. And interestingly, his regrets were linguistic. He said, well, I regret some of these phrases. And in particular, mission accomplished, as he put it, I was trying to convey a message. I could have conveyed it more artfully. Now, I don't disagree with that. If you were looking back on that particular episode with the wisdom of hindsight, you might have gone with something a little more noncommittal, like, way to go, guys, or something like that. But clearly, the breakdown of the administration's language was not simply a question of failing art or artlessness. It was a realization that after a while, even the most skillfully contrived language cannot eternally mask the reality it's trying to spin, and that sooner or later, reality triumphs over these efforts to conceal or euphemize it. It's really a hopeful, in a certain sense, a hopeful conclusion. W. H. Auden put it, one notices, if one will trust one's eyes, the shadow cast by language upon truth. And there is a shadow cast by truth by language upon truth, and one notices the truth after a while. Even more important than that breakdown in the language of the administration was a more profound breakdown in what you could think of as the values talk with which the right had been able to characterize the language of the left and the people on the left since really the Nixon years, since the Southern strategy in the Nixon years, since Nixon and Agnew, in which they were able to define and redefine the fundamental polarities of American politics in terms of differences in personality, differences in consumer habits, differences in style. I try to get at this in the title of my last book, which is called Talking Right, and then had the subtitle, How Conservatives Turned Liberalism Into, and I still have to read this after all these years, tax-raising, latte-drinking, sushi-eating, Volvo-driving, New York Times-reading, body-piercing, Hollywood-loving, left-wing freak show. Those captured this effort to characterize the right, characterize the left, in terms of personality and cultural values rather than political differences. That fell apart in 2008. Not that the Republicans weren't trying. In fact, one of the interesting things about the Republican campaign this last time around was that never before in recent American political history can you think of a campaign in which the Republicans worked this language and these themes more explicitly, more energetically than they did. In particular, of course, Sarah Palin. Country first with the cheers of USA, 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 as if it were a hockey match rather than a political rally. Palling around with terrorists, the pro-American parts of this country, raising the white flag of surrender, and, of course, Joe Sixpack and his flesh and blood avatar, Joe the Plumber. All of those efforts to play these cards more explicitly than they'd ever been played before in American presidential politics, they didn't work. In the end, not enough Americans were willing to register for Joe Sixpack Nation. Now, you could say, well, this year economic issues just trumped cultural issues. People had other things on their mind. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. But it's also clear, both from what the Republicans are doing now and from what happened then, that the next time around, the Republicans are not going to be bringing Joe Sixpack with them when they go into Pennsylvania and Ohio, whoever's their standard bearer. and I think it shows a danger that the Republicans were always running with this kind of language and that then really cost them this time around. The danger is that what sounds just plain folks in one ear is apt to sound condescending in another. I mean, the American common man has never been crazy about being described as the American common man, and I think that's what was behind the reaction to the Republican campaign this year. You began to see the unraveling of a whole vocabulary of the right. The word elite, for example, has been an important word for the right. It's been redefined, almost completely redefined. Originally, it has these two senses, one as in the power elite, the people who have power, money, and influence, and the other in the sense of the social elite, the upper crust, the bon ton, as they used to be called. That's what elite signifies when you see it on the sides of dry cleaners and pastry shops and so on. Agnew was the first one to merge these two in his attacks on the elite media, where he suggested these people not only had power but were effete and pretentious and looked down on ordinary Americans and so on. And that's a theme that the right continued to play more and more effectively over the ensuing decades.
You've forgotten nittering nabobs.
Nattering nabobs of negative. Yeah,
that's
a great phrase by William Safire coined that phrase. Yeah. And it's come to the point where the right has managed to redefine the word elite, so it really doesn't have anything to do with having power or money or influence. It's more a question of attitude. Laura Ingraham, the conservative columnist and the radio host, writes a book, and she says, well, the elite is defined not so much by class or wealth or power or position as they are by a general outlook. Their core belief is that they are superior to we the people. They think we're stupid. They think where we live is stupid. They think our SUVs are stupid. SUVs, by the way, are particularly interesting because initially when they first appeared, they were a sign of liberal affectation and associated with Marin County. And then at a certain point, they got shifted and became a sign of right-wing or plain American values. So by then, elite had become a word that just signified a certain attitude. You could have money and power and influence, and you were not guilty of being elite as long as you didn't have these attitudes. The extreme case occurred during this election when Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, an American millionaire who married a British aristocrat, went on Larry King and described Barack Obama as an elitist, which was a remarkable thing for an aristocrat with millions of dollars to say. But by that point, it didn't matter. I felt at that point she should have asked her husband what the meaning of chutzpah was. He would have explained it to her. And in fact, although her credentials and the little particle de before her name made it even more ridiculous, her status as an actual a member of the actual elite was not much more marked than of Ingraham herself or Ann Coulter, any of these Ivy League educated lawyers who were accusing the Democrats and liberals of being elitists. In fact, the interesting thing about the word elite is if you hear somebody using the word, it almost surely applies to them. Only people who are, in fact, elite call other people elite. So with all of this, the changes this year, this language has begun to crumble. And you can see it as the Republicans scramble on the right, where this is more dramatic. You can see it as the Republicans scramble to find a new language that will move them back to an economically based populism, away from the cultural populism that they've been dining out on for the last 40 years. And it's there in the Tea Parties. It's there in the efforts to tell the story about the economic breakdown as a story about Washington's failures, and rather than the failures of the banking industry or American corporations. And it's there in particular in this remarkable rebirth of the word socialism, the epithet socialist. I mean, this is a word that Republicans lived for and died for 40 or 50 or 60 years, really since the end of the 19th century. Program, whether it was Social Security or any other social program, could be introduced by the Democrats without the Republicans screaming socialism, socialistic. Harry Truman in 1952 said that when a Republican says down with socialism, he means down with progress. That was Truman. By the end of the Cold War, even before that, the word had disappeared from American politics. Republicans no longer denounced Democratic programs as socialistic. neither Bush nor Cheney ever used the word socialism or socialistic to describe their opponents' policies, not once. So the rediscovery of the word late in this campaign was very interesting. And, in fact, the fact that it came so late was interesting. They first had to go through all these other charges. Obama's inexperienced. He's all talk. He's a defeatist. He's an out-and-out elitist. He's a celebrity. He'll say anything to get elected. Oh, yeah, and did we mention he's a socialist? What's interesting about this charge is that it's surely not going to work for the Republicans as it might once have done. The Harvard School of Public Health did a survey last year, asking Americans what they thought about socialized medicine. Would it be helpful or harmful for America, the American healthcare system? Of the people who answered the question, not all the people felt qualified to answer the question, of the people who answered the question, the majority said it would be helpful. And among people under 35, the proportion who thought socialized medicine was a good thing was 2-1. So if you were born, as first-time voters now are, after the fall of communism and the Berlin Wall, socialism just doesn't have that boogeyman power that it once did. But the Republicans are doing it nonetheless, or at least one sector of the right is doing it nonetheless. And I think what's involved there is a kind of hearth language, what the linguists call a hearth language, which is a language that's died out in public but is still used by old ladies around the fireplace. It's a rump language. It's a language that a group uses, that every group uses after a political setback as it draws in to lick its wounds, and it becomes a mark of solidarity. The trouble being that the more language becomes a mark of solidarity and inclusiveness, it also becomes an exclusive kind of language. There's no way that language like socialism and socialistic is going to enable Republicans linguistically to recapture the ground they've lost. And the only difference, as I say, this happens all the time, both on the left and the right, is that now there's a group of people, Fox News and Hannity and Limbaugh and so on, who have built an economic model that actually rewards failure. There's a sense of if your people are beleaguered and feel in a permanent minority, that's fine for your economic model. Limbaugh does not need for the Republicans to be dominant. In fact, he's doing very well now with the Republicans in this beleaguered position. So for the Republicans, it's a question of fashioning a new kind of populist language based in economic rather than cultural values. It's true of the Democrats, too. What's interesting is that this collapse of the language of the right happened without any help from the Democrats at all. It is not as if they ever came up with that language that they kept talking about in 2004 and after that. And Obama, for all his extraordinary linguistic gifts, did not coin any memorable phrases or any new ways of framing political issues. In fact, he was quite conservative and middle of the road in the actual terminology he used, though enormously eloquent in the way he deployed it. And that's a disadvantage right now for the Democrats, because the great advantage of the Republicans' value language, values, traditional values, and so forth, is that anybody could use it. Not just charismatic people like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, who used it very effectively, but these people like John Kyle and Mitch McConnell, these anti-charismatic figures who had no charisma whatsoever but could deploy this language to great effect. The Democrats do not have language of that sort. And it's not clear how and in what manner they'll develop it. Right now, of course, it's a great age for wonkiness. It's a great age of wonky language. Everybody's concerned with the economy, and people are talking about swaps and legacy assets and shovel-ready and so forth, in the same way that right after 9/11, everybody was talking about jihad and daisy cutters and ground zero. And so that was the language for a year before the language itself settled down. But the Democrats ultimately are going to have to come up with a new language as well, a new kind of populism as well. It isn't clear what form that will take, but what is clear is that in the coming 10 years, the language of American politics is going to change more than it has over the last 40 years. So it's a very interesting time to be observing what's going on. Thank you.
I am required before we start doing questions to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and tonight we are pleased and honored to be talking with political communication expert Dr. Jeffrey Nunberg. Jeff, if you wouldn't mind, I have a whole bunch of questions for you, and I'm hoping that we'll get more from the audience shortly, but I'm going to start with just a couple of my own to provoke you a little bit and maybe provoke some more questions from the audience on this vein, too. First, with respect to the last point you made about the Democrats and President Obama, where would you put the words that he did traffic in during the election, change and hope, in being sort of the coins of his realm, maybe changing the discourse? Because those were ephemeral. They meant different things to different people, but they were definitely part of the discourse, I think. What would you say about that?
Well, I think they're enormously stirring words. They're what Walter Lippmann called political symbols, words that stir emotions after they've been detached from their ideas. And he used them very well, and he was the change. I mean, just look at the guy. Right, he didn't really have to explain what change meant. Just look at me. But they're not words like traditional values and so forth that evoke a particular sensibility, a particular idea of American political life. Everybody, who isn't for change? Clinton was for change, McCain was for change, and so on. Obama just articulated it better. But the kind of language the Democrats need is language that's in a sense not more specific but more evocative. Than that carries a meaning from one speaker to the next. And that they don't have yet, I don't think.
Okay. One more then, real quickly, before we go to these questions. Another premise in the discussion tonight was that, in your words, it's unraveled or fallen apart for the right and or the Republican Party. That's not always the same thing in this country. One place that we know politically that Republicans did well nationally in state efforts was on the question that you didn't want to get into, which was same-sex marriage. And in those states that were doing defensive marriage amendments, or Proposition 8, for example, in this state, the words marriage and civil union are part of our discourse today, and I think we're still negotiating the meaning of that. Do you see that looking forward as a place where people on the political right may try to regain some momentum, or are those kinds of issues something that transcend political right and left?
They certainly don't transcend right and left. I think they've moved so quickly from a position of being almost outside the realm of things one could entertain and seriously in American politics. Two issues that now have to be engaged seriously and that suddenly come to – once you have marriage legalized in, what are we now, four states or perhaps five and perhaps six and so on over the coming years, it's no longer an exotic idea. And one of the interesting things, if you listen to the rhetoric of people who are opposed to it, is that the gags – the homophobic gags, God didn't create Adam and Eve – Steve, he created Adam and Eve, that sort of thing, that you don't hear those anymore. Even they are taking it as a serious political question that has to be dealt with. My sense is that it's moved so quickly into the realm of acceptable for a large number of Americans that it's just not going to work. It'll work in those parts of the country where they're strong anyway. I mean, in the South and the West, but not even in the West, maybe. But I don't think it's going to work for them. One other point I'd make about that is if you look at these words, there's a piece in here where I talk about the ways in which the definitions of these words have changed so rapidly. The Oxford English Dictionary just changed the meaning of revised the definition of a bunch of its words. They revised the definition of couple, which had been defined as a man and a woman, so on and so forth. They revised the definition of love, which until 3 months ago in the Romantic sense was defined in English, about a year ago it was defined in the Romantic sense in the Oxford English Dictionary as that feeling of attraction between a man and a woman, which is the basis of marriage. Now, these definitions were the way people just assumed that these things worked, and not that long ago.
I'm thinking of the divorce rate in this country and astonished at that. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, apropos of that then, if I may go to some of the questions from our audience, I'll start with a couple of, I'll call them nuts and bolts questions about your expertise. And one of our listeners and one of the audience members had a question. At what point does common usage, since we were just talking about common usage, become the accepted norm? And he or she gave this example. For example, how long is it going to take before BBQ or the misspelled barbecue replaces barbecue?
It hasn't already. speaking as a lexicographer in a long time association with the American Heritage Dictionary and so on, usage does ultimately determine what we used to put in the dictionary. We would look for word. Once it's well established, we just used it, and people would get shirty and say, "Oh, this isn't English," and so on. But once it's widely used, it's acceptable. I think that what's going on now is that language is changing very rapidly. There are new modes of discourse. It used to be that usage was visible only in the press. Now there's the internet, and not to mention blogs and tweets and so on and so
texting.
Forth. Texting and whatever. So that usage is changing very rapidly, and that's the way the English language has always worked.
Okay. A follow-up question on that same thing. With your background, how do you separate idioms or geographic buzzwords from your vocabulary without sounding like a purist, a snob, or someone who's misunderstood?
Well, my sense is that the history of the English language, particularly in America over the last century, has been one of increasing colloquiality, conversational, slangy style. The interesting thing is that when you listen to the orators who were famous at the turn of the 20th century, like William Jennings Bryan, it was this highfalutin, high bombastic language that was at a million miles removed from everyday speech. And now, even ordinary political language, the language of speeches, has become much more colloquial. So without getting into particular cases, I think that there's been a kind of convergence, aided again by the language of blogs and so on, which is far more conversational and colloquial than the language of newspapers. When I started blogging, I realized that the forms you used in newspapers wouldn't really do. When I wrote for the New York Times, you would write Senator Edward M. Kennedy, D., Massachusetts, right? You couldn't write Teddy Kennedy. Now, when you get to blogging, you just say Teddy, and people assume you know who you mean.
And you don't even have to spell it the right way.
Right.
Okay. Let me move to some political, tying this to the political, some political-type questions. One of our audience members asked this question. How about Democrats' use of, or if you like, liberals' use of language such as, to challenge what you were saying, middle-class tax cuts, bridge to the 21st century, and it depends on what the meaning of the word is. I have to be wagging my finger when I say that. Okay.
That's very good. Well, it depends what the meaning of the word is unfortunately going to tag Bill Clinton throughout history. You know,
beyond the tombstone,
a century from now, they will still recall that. I don't know if you want to call that democratic language or just Clintonese. Some of these other phrases, you have to make a distinction between buzzwords, things like bridge to the 21st century, or the ownership society, for example, a phrase that the Bush administration floated for a while, didn't really go anywhere. The foreign press had a terrible time with the ownership society. You can't translate the phrase, and they would just throw their hands up and write it in English, in fact. So these buzzwords, which in their nature have a short life and then disappear, with the other kinds of language, traditional values, the family, and so forth, liberal elite, media elite, that have a much longer lifespan, can dominate the political discourse for decades.
So where would you put middle-class tax cut then? That was the other.
Well, example. Tax cuts is a word that every tax relief is a phrase that both the Democrats and Republicans have always loved. And somebody said, well, this phrase was invented by Bush, and I actually tracked it back. No, it was used by Clinton. It was used by Bush Sr. It was used by Carter, and so all the way back to Al Smith. I found talking about it in the context of New York. Middle class is a more interesting word. Because the problem that politicians on both sides have is in talking about class in a country that doesn't admit that there are such things. The only time the right ever uses the word class is when they're talking about class warfare, a phrase that spikes whenever Democrats make a tax proposal or attack a Republican tax proposal. But the Democrats as well never talk about anything but the middle class. They don't talk about the working class, for example. Nobody ever talks about the upper class. At best, some people will talk about working Americans as a kind of code for the lower middle class and working class and so on. But the difficulty in American political discourse is to talk about class without talking about class.
On that last subject, do you think, given the intention to give some kind of tax relief to people who make, or allegedly the majority of the people, is what did they say, 90%, 95% of middle class people will get the tax relief, is perhaps less potent today when being middle class itself means different things in different parts of the country?
It may be. One of the interesting things about middle class is it's so expansive. I have a piece in this book about the word rich, which is a word that nobody will use of themselves. Virtually nobody will say, I'm rich. In fact, Bill Gates was asked, do you think you're rich? He says, well, by certain standards, I'm clearly not middle class anymore.
Tongue circling the cheek here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. The middle class is enormously expansive, and a term that in which most people will include themselves from, as I say, from working class Americans all the way up to managers making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Okay, I should check the time one more time, and just remind our listeners again that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. We're talking with political communication expert Dr. Jeffrey Nunberg. Jeff, a different question from one of our audience members now, and I'll read to you. He says, or she says, you seem to be saying that deft language was primary in the Republicans' ascent in this decade's early years, as well as in the early Republican-dominated eras, I assume going back to the time of Ronald Reagan. Isn't language really secondary to policies in influencing the political direction of the body politic? It's a good question.
I think the answer is ultimately that... yes, it's true. I think what the collapse of the Republican language over the last 4 years of the Bush term shows that mere expressions, war on terror, when they stand up, we'll stand down, all of these phrases couldn't overcome the reality that was before people's eyes, and I think this is as I say a hopeful sign. Now that doesn't mean that you can simply propose policies. Call them whatever you want, sell them with whatever language you like, and that they will be ultimately successful in getting those policies passed and in getting elected. So language plays an enormously important role in mediating between the policies and the way they're perceived and accepted.
Okay. Different question now. In which administration did the word spin, to your knowledge, enter the vocabulary to mean interpreting the facts? And who was the top spinmeister, in your opinion?
Gee. I'm not sure when that phrase first came in. My guess would be the 1980s. It became popular. And like a lot of language in this, and particularly in modern political language, it comes out of advertising and marketing. The idea that words can somehow, naming something can somehow put a policy over or persuade people to vote for a policy that's really not in their best interest, or at least not congenial to their best interest, is one that's very close to the idea that we can find these marketers who will come up with a slogan and a product name that will put our product on the supermarket shelves or get it off the supermarket shelves into people's shopping baskets, or put an IPO over and so on. So this is really part of American consumer culture as much as it is part of political culture. As to who is the best at it, gee, I don't know. Reagan was enormously skilled at a certain kind of sincerity. He had a great gift for believing whatever he happened to be saying at the time, which was as close as you get to political sincerity, I suppose. Bush is very good. Clinton, in his own way, very good. Obama, certainly very good. There are different ways of doing this, and I think we've had a lot of presidents who are good at it.
I will add, if I may, just to that, I've done broadcasting now for so many years I can't even remember, and I started doing presidential debates in the early 1980s. My first exposure to the word spin was in the discussion that followed a presidential debate, and someone nicknamed those rooms the spin room. And what that meant was that usually the hacks who worked for one campaign or another would come out and give you their version of why their candidate mopped the floor with the other guy. And what they did, we called spinning. People who worked in news media referred to that as spinning, like they were trying to spin their version of this. And actually, I think, again, you're the expert on this, but I always thought that was about spinning a yarn, sort of like the old, whatever you call those machines, you're making something out of nothing. That was my first exposure to it.
Or spinning a tail.
Or spinning a tail.
The other way people talk. Yeah. Let me just, in that connection, I think one of the interesting things about not just the last 10 years, but the last 30 or 40 years, is that the increasing sophistication about political language, cynicism about political language, everybody knows words like spin. The adjective Orwellian is now the most widely used adjective derived from somebody's name. It's used even more than a Machiavellian in the press and on the internet. That enormous sophistication, that sense of being hip to what's going on, works both to the advantage of advertisers and politicians. They love nothing more than an audience that feels itself sophisticated and able to see through their language. That's the audience that's easiest to sell.
Right. Okay. In the spirit of following up some of those words, one of the audience members said, or asked rather, could you please define the word neoconservative? And again, sort of asking for the origins of this, if you don't mind doing some etymology, where did the word come from and who does it describe?
Well, somebody joked that conservative and neoconservative means conservative and the neo means Jewish. It grew up among a group of intellectuals associated with Irving Kristol's journal magazine, The Public Interest.
Right.
I don't know when the phrase first was used, maybe the 1980s again, and became associated with a certain variety of conservatism, economically conservative, very much involved in an aggressive foreign policy, and perhaps less concerned, except in an opportunistic way, with the social issues that concerned other religious conservatives, for example.
And if I may tack on to that, that's exactly right. The other part of that I would describe for whomever asked the question, it was very much a product of when the Republican Party changed in this country, brought in Southern Democrats and expanded its base. Republicans were very much aware of the fact that for years Democrats had had their own think tanks and a sort of infrastructure to support their cause, and they began developing their own think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, for example, and others. And out of places like that and the one that Jeffrey mentioned came thinkers who had terms and labels for what they were doing, and neoconservative was one of those, definitely. These are some of the people he's mentioned who drew up the blueprint, for example, for going into Iraq and then made that about the war on terror after the fact. Okay, different question on that. Your thoughts on the use of the word homeland with reference to the United States vis-a-vis the so-called war on terror? What do you think about the word homeland?
Yeah, it was fascinating when that word came out. It was proposed in, I guess, was it 2001 or 2002, shortly after 9/11, the Office of Homeland Security, attacks on the homeland, phrases like that. There's something, it's an old English word. It goes back to the 18th century. People have talked about homeland and so on, but it's not a word that the English-speaking peoples in general, or Americans in particular, have ever been comfortable applying to their own country. You know, the Germans have a homeland, the Italians have a homeland, the Czechs have a homeland. We've got a country.
Should we have said motherland?
Motherland would have been either word.
And
I've often thought that that's because we don't have this sense of soil, of the soil as being the determinant factor. It's more, at least officially, our common political and social ideals than our commonalities of blood and soil. As I've said, America's not a place that people come from. It's a place that people come to. And homeland, in a sense, seems almost to betray that notion. I'm glad it hasn't caught on, except in the name of the agency.
In that spirit, a follow-up question. What about the word terrorism today?
Well, the war on terror actually goes back to before the Bush years, but the war against terrorism tended to be the more common phrase until Bush made it the war on terror. The war on, that construction, is the one we use when we're fighting endemic conditions, the war on sin, the war on alcohol, the war on drugs, the war on prostitution, and so on. So there was a sense in the phrase that it allowed us basically to take on anybody. I mean, terror was just a method, and it allowed us to take on anybody or anything that was vaguely associated with terror, and a way, of course, of concealing glossing over the fact that this was directed at a particular form of Islamic Islamism, and also tended to emphasize the military at the expense of the diplomatic and economic parts of the campaign. So it was, although it was very useful for the Bush administration, it also came at a considerable cost. And I think the Bush administration itself tried to distance themselves from the phrase at one point. It didn't work. Bush still wanted it. But now that he's out, the phrase should be retired. It's not helpful.
Hmm. Okay. Different kind of question now. One of our audience members wrote, do you believe that certain racial, ethnic, economic groups in society, or economic groups in society, for example, African Americans or immigrants, etc., are deliberately excluded from mainstream political discourse?
I don't know if they're excluded from discourse. There is certainly a kind of code language, what people sometimes call dog whistle politics, particularly with regard to immigrants and other groups that are historically unrepresented, that marginalizes these groups in the same way that Bush used, the Republicans used a kind of coded language to appeal to certain segments of American religious groups, the Christian right, mm-hmm. Without seeming ostensibly seeming to make that appeal. So yeah, sure, and particularly in the way we talk about immigration, for example.
Well, as a follow-up then, a different, I think, listener or audience member had written, why do movements target words to create discussion? For example, lady being called woman, or from Negro to black to African American, et cetera.
When you want to signal a change in social attitudes, the first thing that people do is to try to find, to introduce new language to talk about things. Negro replaced colored after a long struggle on the part of, let me just say, African American leaders. The Times adopted the word finally, I think, in 1931. The Wall Street Journal waited until the late 40s, I think, to adopt the word. But there was a sense that we want a new attitude, and this new word will signal that attitude. And then, of course, black and African American in turn replaced Negro. And similarly with just about every important topic in American politics. Suicide, for example, is in certain jurisdictions, certainly in Oregon and now in California, a contested notion. And the people who are supporting, let me put this in a neutral way, the right of people with terminal diseases to secure aid in ending their lives have been fighting against the word suicide precisely because they feel that it comes with a set of connotations that make it very difficult to establish their point of view. And they point out, for example, that suicide was not used to describe the people who jumped from the World Trade Center on 9/11. They were described as homicides caused by the terrorists. Well, sure, but they did, because of hopeless circumstances, choose to end their lives in one way, say, rather than another. So every time this happens, there's a semantic brouhaha of this sort. And even if attitudes don't change, it makes people conscious of the issues in a way that's, I think, salubrious. I think it helps. Even if you're people who are still diehard anti-feminist and so on, no longer refer to their secretaries as my gal, for example. That just you just don't say that. And there's a kind of heightened consciousness even among the most recalcitrant segments of American society because of these linguistic changes.
Okay. Moving from, I guess, the cultural now to the financial, a different audience member wrote, could you please comment on banking and financial language, its intent, its effect on the population? For example, derivatives or credit default swap.
Well,
you wanted to get wonky.
That,
we're getting wonky.
As I say, they're like the military terms, like daisy cutter, that appeared in the language for a little while. And my sense is that they're beyond the comprehension of most Americans, certainly beyond my comprehension. And and that although they're in the news now, they're not going to be part of the American vernacular. What's interesting is the way that the meanings of certain of these terms have changed. Home equity loan was introduced in the late 1970s, early 1980s by banks who felt that the notion of a second mortgage was a little disparate. I mean, you know, people had second mortgages. That was a sort of desperation thing to do. So we're going to introduce these new products called home equity loans. And that was the new shiny euphemism for these second mortgages that people didn't want. Well, and this is an excellent case of reality catching up with language, home equity loan is no longer a shiny euphemism. It's tainted with the same kind of bad associations that second mortgage had at one point. So I think those parts of the language that do the financial language that do enter ordinary usage rapidly become adopted to the needs that people have.
Let me ask that question a slightly different way. Maybe this is where the audience member was going with this too. Is it possible that the technical, almost impenetrable nature of those words was exactly the sort of thing that masked what people were doing with those financial practices, made it complicated for people to understand in the first place?
I don't know if it made it complicated for ordinary Americans. It was complicated enough. I think it may have made it complicated for the regulators.
And
the oversight bodies who had no idea what any of this stuff was about and yet had to pretend to understand it. I think it's also interesting. I mean, certainly this language has worked its way into the American vocabulary as people become, in a certain sense, more sophisticated about this. I was tracing at one point the word economy itself. There's a Bruce Springsteen song that goes, "Lately I ain't been working much." It's one of these first-person narratives, populist narratives. "I ain't been working much on account of the economy." Now, that was a sentiment that you might have found in a Woody Guthrie song, but he would never have talked about the economy. He would have said, "On account of times are bad." And the economy is an example of one of these terms from the social sciences, particularly economics, that's worked its way into ordinary, everyday usage. And that's really the history of the 20th century, is sociology, psychology, economics, anthropology. All of these fields introduced new words that have worked their way into values, in that sense. Was an introduction from German sociology, long before Spiro Agnew got hold of it.
Okay. Staying on the financial just for a moment, now we'll be shifting to taxes. With regard to the California special election next week, you should all vote, by the way. The pro and con commercials we've seen don't seem so far to resonate with voters. How can state politicians best communicate the needs of California to voters? So I'll ask this question a different way. If you were in charge of giving the governor and the legislature and the people in favor of the propositions some advice about language, what would you tell them about how to communicate California's needs?
Well, you know, I have to say I haven't been following this election. I got the voter pamphlet, and I thought, I got to read that, but I haven't read it yet. So I can't speak to this in general. I think it's very difficult. The initiative system in particular, which was introduced to return power to the people at the expense of the special interest, has been in certain ways very effective. When you're dealing with things that people understand, like the death penalty, whether you think the answers came out well or not, or Prop 8, people at least understood what was at stake, more or less. When you come to these tax issues and so on, the question of whether there can be language that does justice to the complexities isn't easy to answer. Walter Lippmann, one of my favorite writers about political language, said at one point, "The facts exceed our curiosity," and I think this is a characteristic problem of particularly of states in which the initiative process is charged with so much political work.
Since Lippmann also used that as an explanation for why we needed news media to frame things for us. Different question. Do you think people who work in news media are part of the problem with the nature of the language that we're talking about, that they're not good about having the kind of discussion that you're having now? Or are they merely reflecting the public attitudes at this point? What's your view of that?
Well, the media, you know, is a term that covers a lot of ground. I think American media, mainstream media, as they're called, by and large, if they're still around in 5 years, much less 50,
have been
maybe less independent than they might have been over recent years in reporting these stories, and maybe in the interest of balance, too easily persuaded to soft pedal, even when a story clearly had one side of a story was clearly right, they would feel obliged to report the other side just in the interest of balance. And they've certainly been very willing to adopt the language of whatever administration, particularly the Bush administration, but whatever administration happens to be selling its language. So I already mentioned estate tax, personal accounts, faith-based initiative. The use of faith rather than religion, which implies a certain point of view, was adopted almost universally. I say almost because the New York Times and the Washington Post didn't do it to their credit. They talked about religion-based initiatives. But faith was really the word that the press adopted or the media adopted because the administration had. And they'll go along.
I would agree. Well, I'm afraid that our time is at an end. Our special thanks to Dr. Jeffrey Nunberg, the author of The Years of Talking Dangerously. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, I'm Joe Tooman, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you for being here.